You are tuning into Pro Bono Perspectives, live from Brooklyn, where the city never sleeps and purpose is more than just a buzzword. Pro Bono Perspectives brings together leaders that have traveled across sectors, industries, and experiences on their path to creating change for the communities in which they live and work. And I'm your host, Danielle Holly, CEO of Common Impact, a national nonprofit that designs skills-based volunteer programs that amplify the impact of social change organizations by harnessing the talents and the skills of private sector employees. I am lucky enough to cross paths with these leaders every day through my work with Common Impact and can't wait to bring you behind the scenes to share their stories. Today, I'm joined by Anthony Bug-Levine, who is the CEO of the Nonprofit Finance Fund. NFF is a nonprofit and community development financial institution, a CDFI, that gives millions of dollars in loans to fellow nonprofits and advocates for fundamental improvements in how money is given and used in the sector. In his role, he forges partnerships to fund and implement NFF's work, and he shares what his team learns about how to spread power in the form of money and financial knowledge. On today's podcast, Anthony and I talk about the systemic challenges that undergird the nonprofit sector, how that disproportionately impacts communities of color, and how he and his team are guiding mission-based organizations through the economic crisis of COVID-19. We recorded our conversation in the midst of the Black Lives Matter uprising following George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis, and he shares, as a white leader, why he's not speaking out. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to Pro Bono Perspectives. So glad to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So give our listeners a little bit of your background. You have a little bit of finance. You've worked in the nonprofit sector. You were at Rockefeller Foundation, the Global Impact Investing Network, McKinsey. Tell us about your career journey and how those experiences help feed what you're doing today.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's funny when you do job interviews, you're asked to kind of create a narrative arc around your career. And it's easy to look back and do that. I wouldn't say that in reality, it felt as intentional as I was going through it. But basically, I've always been interested in the question of really, I came at this more from a social justice perspective rather than from the finance perspective. But early on in my career, had reasons to recognize that the way that money works and the power that is held by business is centrally important to understand and influence for people who do want to make a contribution to the world becoming a more just and vibrant place. And so I really began my work from background in human rights. I actually am South African originally. I'm a third generation Southern African, was raised there, came to the US when I was 10. And while I was in college is when South Africa had its liberation election and Nelson Mandela became president. And shortly after that, I had an opportunity to go back. Shortly after college, I was working in South Africa at the Human Rights Commission, very much thinking my career would be down the road of human rights and policy and advocacy. But I was able to work at the Human Rights Commission, and we were made aware of a situation in northern South Africa near the Zimbabwean border where a group of farmers, of black farmers, were being just brutalized by the local white farm owners. These were sort of farm laborers. And even though apartheid had officially ended and on paper, we were the freest country in the world, our constitution guaranteed rights that most other countries didn't have. The reality of those farmers' lives was that they had no capacity to realize those rights because they lived in a part of the country where the entire economy was controlled by this group of white people, very similar to who had always done so under apartheid. And so there was very little ability for people to exercise the rights they had on paper. And understanding that and seeing how important it was not to have economic power as a substitute for rights, but to have economic power as a complement to the rights that had been won through a liberation struggle that ended up in a constitutional victory, really helped steer me toward a set of steps that was about understanding how business works. That's why I went to the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton and got a degree in development economics, just trying to understand how economics worked. Then realizing that it was important to understand how business works to be effective. And so I went to McKinsey for a few years, ran a nonprofit in Kenya that was focused on helping farmers get the most out of their production by creating more effective supply chains that would allow them to command better prices and markets for their produce. And then ended up at the Rockefeller Foundation, where I wasn't hired to do it, but over the course of my first year there, ended up leading what became the Impact Investing Initiative. And then finally have been in the last almost 9 years at the Nonprofit Finance Fund, where I have the privilege every day of being able to put all the theory around how do you get money into the hands of incredible organizations so that they can be liberated to realize their own potential. And I get to do that every day with an amazing team and an incredibly inspiring set of clients.
And tell us more about the work of the Nonprofit Finance Fund. This statement on the website describes the funding system that nonprofits rely on as flawed and inequitable. And I know one of the things that NFF does is to get capital to social services and nonprofit organizations that are serving populations that have not had access to the same opportunities of the general populace. So, like, curious, particularly now, like, we're recording this in June 8th, and we're in the midst of an uprising against the racial injustices that we've been exposed to. How does NFF think about this? How does it integrate into your work?
Yeah, that's great. It's a set of questions. I'll take them.
There are three or four in there.
Yeah. No, but it's really important because all of us, I believe, people of conscience in America are really being called to ask, what are we doing in order to be part of the solution? And it is an incredible privilege to be an organization which has been thinking about that for a long time, and to be able to go to work every day, knowing that in our small and esoteric way, we get to be part of making our country more just, really by working through our clients, importantly, not by assuming we're doing it ourselves. But it's been not only important now this month, but certainly for the last few years, been a very important way to find work that's meaningful and that feels responsive to what's happening in the country. But I'll go back to, you know, what it is that we do. You know, if you look at it, technically, we provide loans to nonprofits around the country. We have about 100, because we closed a loan last week, 100 borrowers around the country. They are soup kitchens, food banks, charter schools, health clinics, some museums, theaters. And we provide them with loans, in many cases, loans that the banks are unwilling to make for a set of reasons I'm happy to get into. We also have a team that works across the country, mostly advising nonprofit leaders on financial strategy and helping nonprofits and to a lesser degree foundations and government funders get clearer about how money works in their organization and ultimately how they can mobilize and use money most effectively to pursue their mission in a resilient way. And then the third part of NFF is to take the learnings that we get from the clients we lend to and the clients that we serve as advisors and advocate for changes in the way the funding system works that would make it easier for these organizations to be more effective. So that's what we do technically. And, you know, we were born in 1980. We're 40 years old in what would now be called green retrofit finance. The term didn't exist back then, but our NFF was created in response to a set of large nonprofits in New York City who went to their donors and said, we need a larger grant next year because our heating oil bills are going up because the oil price had spiked in the late 1970s. And the NFF was born out of an idea that was both incredibly banal, but also quite revolutionary. And that is, you don't need a bigger grant to pay a bigger heating oil bill. If instead you can take out a loan, which allows you to put a more fuel efficient boiler in your basement, put new windows in that trap the heat, that allows you to actually use less oil. And even though the price has gone up, by using less oil, you'll make enough savings, you can pay the loan off. On one hand, that's incredibly banal because it's the way most companies have always worked. When you have a need for capital improvements, you borrow against the productivity gains you'll get from those capital improvements, you pay off your loan. It was revolutionary because at the time, it was still assumed that nonprofits shouldn't be thinking of themselves as in that way or shouldn't have access to those basic financial products. I mean, some nonprofits certainly had loans, the larger ones, but in general, the idea was and still is in many cases that nonprofits should simply wait until they raise money from donors before they do anything like invest in themselves. And so we were born out of this very simple idea. And then from then, obviously, the work has substantially evolved. But what I'd say is technically we make loans, provide financial advice and advocate. But what we really do is bring power in the form of money and financial insight to organizations who can use that power to be more effective in building the just and vibrant society that they do in their communities. And that can sound very lofty and like a slogan. But one thing I've come to realize over the last year is that I hadn't really appreciated when I first joined NFF is just how real that is, that money alone and knowledge is power. And I'll give you a specific example. We work with an amazing organization in the Bronx in New York that's been working to support young people involved in the criminal justice system, helping them stay out of prison and helping them not go back to prison. And more than just doing it themselves, they organize the entire community. They wrap the community's arms of love around these kids. And that's what they do on a day-to-day basis, and they serve hundreds of kids. They also, their leader is one of an inspiring group of people around the country, even before the latest uprisings around criminal justice reform, who has been advocating for an end to all youth incarceration. Their goal is not to reduce the imprisonment of kids. It's to end the practice of imprisoning children in this country, something that other countries have been able to do and we haven't. And so we were able to provide that. Now, that's what they do at a noble level. What the day-to-day, they also are a nonprofit and they have to run that nonprofit and they have to pay their bills. And like many nonprofits, and this goes back to your question about how does the system make it hard for these organizations to succeed? Most nonprofits operate in an environment in which generating operating reserves over time is stigmatized. Donors do not like when a nonprofit has reserves because they say, well, if you've got money in the bank, then why do you need my funding? So this is an organization like many that doesn't have a lot of operating reserves. In the surveys we've been doing over the years, it's pretty consistent that half of all nonprofits in America have 90 days or less of cash on hand at any given time. So on one hand, they're operating very thin reserves. They're also operating a system in which they tend to not get paid on time. So this organization received a grant from the government, $2 million a year, but they have to do the work and then invoice the government and then wait until the payment comes through. So when that organization won, you know, got that grant, they said, we thought that our prayers had been answered until they realized a month later it was going to bankrupt them because they had to now incur hundreds of thousands of dollars of costs before they could get to the point where they could bill the government, and then the government is going to pay them on a delay. NFF was able to get them a $1 million line of credit. It's such a simple financial tool, but it is transformational in the ability of the leadership of that organization to spend their time serving those kids right. and advocating for the end of youth incarceration rather than struggling to figure out how they're going to balance their creditors. And the head of that organization, you know, said to my team when we asked him, what did our loan mean to you? He said, it means that I can be here today talking to you about how we're going to end youth incarceration in our lifetimes in this country, rather than hiding in my apartment under the sheets, ashamed to face my staff because I cannot pay them. And that kind of insight is what really drives me to realize that something as simple as a $1 million line of credit can actually be a transfer of power to an amazing leader who now gets to spend his time focused on what he can do best for his work in our country. And similarly, we could be, you know, I could tell you similar stories of what happens to leaders who get the financial knowledge my consulting team offers that helps them realize that finance is something they can use as a tool to you know, make their organizations more resilient rather than something that is either a distraction or at worst, something that undermines their ability to do their work.
And one of the things, I mean, Common Impact is so focused on this issue of capacity building, and we've done a lot of research on it, and it's mind-boggling, right? There's just so much misinformation out there, and the stigma that you mentioned around nonprofits not being able to, quote-unquote, make a profit, right? I've had board members tell me that, and Common Impact is a nonprofit for context. And where do you think that is coming from? I mean, companies, for-profit institutions, have upwards of 35% of their annual revenues fed back into the infrastructure and the capacity of their businesses, because that's what allows their businesses to run and to scale. Where does this come from, this stigma that nonprofits shouldn't also do that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've certainly been radicalized in the last few years, and I've heard different answers to that question, and I'm now inclined to believe the people who say it comes from the fact that people who are funders are hoarding power by keeping organizations from having reserves and by restricting funding. The other great sin of the funding world is that so much of donations are restricted to specific activities that an organization has to pursue, rather than giving these organizations the money to respond to their community's needs and aspirations in ways that they see fit. Those are the twin, you know, children of what is basically a system organized around the hoarding of power by funders. You know, I fundamentally believe that on a fundamental level, funders and, you know, and most certainly on the human services side, most nonprofits are funded primarily by government. It's not just private donors. So when we talk about funders, we don't just mean individuals writing checks. We also mean a large share of the money that comes from government funding. It's about control. And, you know, when you know an organization has reserves and they don't need you, and that's giving up power. And when you give them unrestricted funding, it certainly is organized around the idea that the organization themselves should know better than you do what to do with it. And that's just, it's something that most funders are very uncomfortable with. You know, I often get asked by individual donors, well, how could I possibly give a general support grant? Because if I don't tell them what they're going to spend the money on, how can I trust them to do good work? And, you know, my answer is always, well, why would you ever give money to an organization that you wouldn't trust? Darren Walker, the president of the Ford Foundation, who's been an amazing mentor, he was my boss at Rockefeller, been incredibly supportive to me and hundreds, if not thousands, of other people. He's been very clear on this. He's committed Ford to, you know, one of the largest foundations in the country to be spending much more of their money on general support grants. And, you know, he says in response to that question, in my experience, if you give dedicated and effective nonprofit leaders general support, they will spend the money on the thing that is most strategic to serve their community. And the likelihood of that happening is it's far more likely than if you sit as a funder and try and think you know better than they do what to do. But it is ultimately about control. And I often think about, you know, when you think of the way most nonprofits are financed, we give them money, we tell them, we make them agree ahead of time what they will spend the money on rather than just letting them choose. Then we make them account for how they spent the money. And if there's any money left over, we make them give that money back. There are people in our lives who we treat that way with money, and that's our children. That's what you do with a 6 or 7 year old. And yet it's what you're doing with you know, adults whose work ultimately is the only way to turn that money into social progress. So I think we have to look at and be comfortable talking about where this comes from. And it's not just technical. It is ultimately about hoarding control. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, we are having this conversation in the midst of an uprising that is, you know, a generation and more of people saying, we aren't willing to live anymore in a system in which power is hoarded in the way it has been, especially hoarded by white people and in order to control and undermine Black people. And I think there's a very similar dynamic within the nonprofit sector. Of course, it's worse for organizations led by people of color, and especially organizations led by Black people. The data is out there that the distrust, the restrictions, the likelihood of not receiving support grants, of receiving smaller grants, all that is made worse when the leadership is people of color and African Americans, and when those are the communities they serve.
And how do you think about that as a white man leading an organization that is fighting against the systemic change? I often think about it for myself as a white woman leading a nonprofit, and, you know, the people of color that are on my staff are in more junior positions, and it feels really important to have a role in reducing our privilege, right? Or using our privilege to support Black voices and the voices of people of color and the systems that we change without taking up our own space while we do that. And curious how you think about that, just personally and within NFF.
That's a great question. And I would premise any answer to a question like that to say, I claim no expertise or moral authority to have said I've done this well, but it is really important that as white people, we don't wash our hands of our own obligations to be exerting our energies to confront and ultimately dismantle the system that has most benefited us. I think there's a real mistake that many of us, and I probably subscribed to this a little bit when I was younger, was, you know, our job is to step aside and let sort of Black people lead. And of course, the challenge with that in general is that the system of white supremacy benefits us. And so, you know, it is an obligation we have to do the work. I think from a leadership perspective, one of the dangerous things that a lot of organizations do is place the burden of equity work on the staff of color, which is something that certainly at NFF, you know, we've committed not to do. It's unfair to take people who are being most oppressed by a system and then asking them to do the extra work while everyone has a day job, to then go and, you know, staff the equity committee or write the statements and so forth. So we've committed at NFF that, you know, this is going to be an endeavor that I personally lead, I co-lead with what's now, we formed an equity council internally, but it's been a real journey for us. NFF, as I said, we claim no success yet, but you know, we're working hard. And it didn't begin with us, thankfully, now, nor did it begin when Trump got elected. It really began the work of being conscious about what we're going to do differently in the summer of 2016. And that was, I don't know if you recall, there was a weekend of late June, early July, when there was a, you know, another very highly publicized police shooting murder in Minneapolis, of all places, which was Philando Castile. And then Alton Sterling got killed in Louisiana. And then there was a incident in Dallas where cops were shot. And it all kind of happened that week. And my team, you know, my senior team, which at the time, to our shame, was all white, came to me and said, what are we going to do? We provide loans and we provide technical assistance. And that just doesn't feel like it's what this country needs. I mean, we want to be a part of the solution. I think there's often this need of, how do we become a part of the solution? There's a desire to do that. And of course, the first thing to recognize is that we provide loans and consulting services and advocacy around finance. And so it's important not to try and insert ourselves into places where we don't necessarily have a key role to play. You know, we made a choice not to be people who spend our working days as community activists on the streets. And so trying to find our own lane, but it certainly led us to doing work then that was about understanding what it would take to really transform NFF into an anti-racist organization that was making a much more intentional contribution to liberation in this way. It's been a, you know, as these journeys are, a lot more false starts than successes. And, you know, we've certainly done some work to identify how in our own work we are implicitly biased. I think in the, you know, in the lending side of this, we are a community finance organization. There's about 1,200 of them around the country. We were born out of the civil rights movement. You know, happy to talk a little bit more about that later. But I think the instinct is to say, well, how do you remove implicit biases from your hiring? How do you remove them from your lending work, from your core work as a nonprofit? And that's really only the scratching the surface, because it's not just about removing biases. It's about understanding the ways in which you can be making a much more intentional contribution. And so we try to do that. But you know, what's really live right now is a decision we made over the last 72 hours not to release an external statement in solidarity with the uprisings that are happening around the country. Of course, I made an internal statement, but we really want to honor the idea that now is the time to center Black voices and not our own. So I think as a white leader, we have to confront the idea that on one hand, it's our obligation to be part of the solution, but we genuinely have to support others. And so we've been trying to amplify the voices of our peers in the funding world, in the community finance world, who are African-American and frankly have a lot more insight than I could share at this moment. And then there are other times when we, you know, will be very intentional about standing in solidarity with others. But it's going to be an interesting shift from the rhetoric to really seeing whether people are willing to share power.
And it does feel different this time. It feels like it has more energy, more power. And with every headline that comes up around this, the racial injustice, the racial inequities, the headlines fade. And then I think it moves out of consciousness, particularly for white people who don't have to deal with it. And there's just, I hope, a real energy and power behind it this time. You know, thinking about COVID-19, similar to what we were talking about with capacity building and the stigmas on the nonprofit sector disproportionately impacting Black-led, people of color-led organizations, there's a deeper level of distrust. Similarly, COVID has impacted those organizations more deeply, and they have struggled to recover as a general assessment of the impacts. And curious how you all are thinking about that, anything that you would share with, in general, what NFF is doing to support organizations during this time of real financial crisis. This is your expertise. But also if those lines show up for you there with clients that are divided amongst racial lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, not just the way the crisis landed disproportionately in communities of color. You know, in this case, if you look at the disease itself, it was primarily in African-American and Latinx neighborhoods. In New York, a little bit, also in the Asian American neighborhoods in Queens, just because of how the way the disease itself flowed through. But I think what's also really interesting, where NFF does have, you know, another advocacy voice, is not just around the crisis, but the response. And one of the things we've been very clear about is recognizing that the federal response of unprecedented size in terms of the so far four rounds of federally funded bailout or stimulus money, most notably the what's called the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, that was $600 billion, I think, in two rounds, targeted to support small businesses to survive. Nonprofits, thankfully, over decades of advocacy, were finally written into that legislation. For many years, when that kind of support was created, nonprofits were just left out because of our tax status, even though in many, functionally, most nonprofits are small businesses. You know, employ people, they do very much the same thing these small businesses do. So when this program was created, and it was created to support these small businesses and nonprofits, it unfortunately was, well, either unfortunately or intentionally, depending on who you want to believe, run through the Small Business Administration, and therefore disproportionately made that money, that bailout money, available to businesses and nonprofits who had existing banking relationships with banks that worked with the SBA. So what happened was, there wasn't enough money in it, which meant it became a first come, first serve program. And the first people to be served were the ones who had banking relationships. And so what became really evident to the small business lenders who are our peers in the community finance space, as well as those of us who do the nonprofit lending, was just, and advising, was how that particular bailout program was passing over disproportionately nonprofits, in our case, and small businesses led by or owned by people of color and African Americans especially. So I think it's both the way the crisis hit in a disproportionate way, as well as the way in which the bailout money didn't get to where it needed to go. So, you know, you asked what's NFF's response has been, to be clear in our advocacy, that we got a lot of calls from funders the 2 days before the applications opened up for that major program, saying, I'm incredibly nervous, these foundations, I'm incredibly nervous that my grantees are not going to access this funding. Will NFF do trainings? We want to pay you to do trainings and help these organizations access the funding. And we turned those down, most of those requests, because we really felt that it was almost too late. The moment that Congress decided that this was going to flow through the SBA, you'd almost lost the ability to really make this an equitable bailout. And so one of the things we've been advocating for is to be able to demonstrate in this moment now a new way of flowing that kind of money through community finance institutions rather than the SBA, with the intention that that then creates a different conduit. So on one hand, we need to build the financial infrastructure that gets money to reach these marginalized groups. And then we need to muster the political will so that the next time there is an opportunity to do this kind of relief work, the money flows through a set of infrastructure that can more effectively reach these organizations. So NFF has been doing advocacy work around that, as well as participating in a few pilots at kind of a city or county level that are trying to show how you can actually make this money available through the community finance infrastructure rather than the established banks. And so I think it's really important to recognize that in a way, looking back, it was obvious and inevitable that both the crisis and the response was going to be inequitable in how it was experienced. But again, the question is, what are we all going to do so that that's not a morally or professionally acceptable response?
How have you experienced the digital divide playing into this? You know, so much of what I have been exposed to in terms of where some of those inequities exist is, particularly now with the current environment that we're all in, that lack of access to technology is just amplifying all those impacts, where, you know, students that are in lower income communities they actually can't engage in virtual classrooms in the way that their more affluent counterparts can. And so how are you seeing this impact organizations from a financial management perspective?
That's a great question. You know, as I said, we do finance charter schools around the country. Many of them work with students who are primarily people of color, kids of color, African American, Latinx a lot of times. Many of them are working in very low income neighborhoods and doing unbelievable work. And we actually, one of my clients has a school who's part of a movement within the school movement to create intentionally diverse schools. So often we finance schools that are 99, 100% low-income kids, 98% kids of color. In this case, the school is intentionally bringing diversity around race and income, because there's a whole philosophy in the school movement that says the best way you generate life-changing, long-term sustained outcomes for poor kids and kids of color is to actually create a much more integrated schooling for them. So their entire reason to exist as a school is to reduce the racial and wealth gap in educational outcomes. And they were doing an amazing job. And then COVID hit, and overnight, that was going to reassert itself, both in terms of the difficulty that kids were going to have in equally accessing their online education, and importantly, in the inability to create summer programming that had been a central component of how you reduce the gap. You know, there's a lot of evidence that one of the big reasons why that gap exists is not just what happens in the classroom, but what's called the summer learning gap. Kids from different backgrounds return to school having retained less depending on who they are. So, you know, that was a really incredible, but in that case, that organization had connections, was able to talk to a tech company, get every kid in their school a laptop for free. And I think a lot of our clients have been able to mobilize in that way. I worry about the people who don't have those kinds of connections. At a macro level for nonprofits, you know, we're really seeing that this digital divide, there's a real risk. And in fact, the trajectory we're on, unless we all do something about it, is that the recovery from this crisis is going to exacerbate inequalities. And I already mentioned one element, which is who gets to access government funding and therefore survive. The other thing we're seeing is that, you know, it's not just a narrative. I think there's a real danger right now that COVID and is being described in the nonprofit world as just a crisis or just a tragedy or just stress. The reality is that nonprofit leaders around the country are creative, innovating. I mean, I'm in awe of the schools that overnight almost flipped how they teach. I'm in awe of the community center in New York who we financed, who were a community center for elderly people in their community, in ethnic immigrant community. And almost overnight, they went from supporting their clients in the center to mobilizing 100 people to deliver food to them in their apartments because they no longer could come to the center. There's amazing innovation and creativity. And for some of them, they've actually shown that the crisis has allowed them, and I'd say it's true for us at NFF, to realize that we can actually be more productive than we had been. So some organizations are using mobile to provide care for, you know, medical care, mental health services, aren't requiring people to make it to the clinic anymore, which used to involve 3 bus rides for people that didn't have cars and so forth. So we're actually seeing that for some organizations, this has been an opportunity to innovate on a rapid scale and realize that there are ways to come out of this even more productive and effective. But that's where there's going to be a major divide, because it is the large organizations that had either connections or the resources and the savvy to set up these online systems who are going to come out of this even more effective in serving clients. And the smaller, and especially the community-based groups that, you know, are providing services culturally appropriate in a language to a small community that just simply cannot be delivered effectively at scale with dignity and respect. Those groups are the ones we really worry about, because they're going to come out of this unable to make those investments and therefore for falling even further behind. So I think it's a very real concern. It's around the digital, but it's in everything. You know, organizations with reserves are going to be able to come out of this and start again. Part of the challenge is it's not just flipping a switch and going back to normal. It's people are going to have to spend money to figure out how to deliver services for this interim period where we're going to have to be social distancing and so forth. And who gets to and who doesn't get to do that is very highly correlated with who is more community-centered, and who serves and is led by people of color. So there's a real danger that the crisis will be the first blow that exacerbates inequality, but then the way we do the recovery period will make things even worse.
Well, and in general, and I remember this from the 2008 crisis, even taking away those layers, that the impact on nonprofits financially tends to be staged a bit later than the overall economic impact or the start of the recessions because of the philanthropic dollars and that cycle, and individual donations. And so one of the things that I've heard from a lot of nonprofits is they're figuring it out for this year. And as you said, incredibly innovative. And there's real concern around what happens in 2021. So for the listeners right now, and it's many of them who are working at nonprofits, small organizations, what resources would you point them to, both for the advocacy side that you mentioned before, because I think that's an incredibly powerful piece of it, but also just the tactics of how do they get their arms around this very ambiguous environment that we're in?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think one of the motivating forces in our work is the recognition that very few nonprofit leaders love finance. It's not why they joined the job. You know, our clients are the school teacher who started an aftercare program. It's the social worker who started an elder care program. It's the radical activist who went and got a medical degree in order to bring primary care into their community who now runs a health clinic. None of them love finance. And yet navigating finance ultimately becomes an essential element to being able to realize the aspiration of their organization and their community. And so, you know, the work we're always doing is to help people who aren't finance experts and for whom it shouldn't be where they pay most of their attention, get enough confidence and skills around how to use finance so that they can really pursue their mission. And we have free resources, you know, a lot of people have free resources right now. NFF.org, our website, is all COVID page. We've got a bunch of it up in Spanish as well. But, you know, we have free resources around what ultimately I think the challenge for all nonprofits at all times, but especially now, is you have to take command of your financial story. And in order to do that, you have to know what is going on in your organization. You have to have the systems in place. You have to confront the need to understand what's happening with the way money flows in your organization rather than burying your head in the sand, which is a completely understandable reaction. You also need to understand that in many cases, the situation you're in is not your fault, that you are being asked to operate in a system that, as we said earlier, does not exist in order to enable you to succeed if success includes having agency and power. And so understanding the financial system you're in, but most importantly, just taking control of your own financial story. And that's about knowing where money is coming in, knowing when it's going out, making hard decisions in a timely way, which you have to do, and then having the confidence to talk to your donors about what it is you need. And I'm not so reckless as to say, you know, all nonprofits should be demanding general support and turning down anyone who offers you restricted funding. I think that would be malpractice for the nonprofit to unilaterally disarm from the system would be malpractice for us to advise. At the same time, we're doing everything we can to try and change the way that donors operate. But in the meantime, I really urge people to take control, understand what's happening, and at least on the margins, have greater confidence expressing with clarity what you need from donors. They won't always respond, but if you don't ask, you know for sure you're not going to get it. You really, and then the other say, you know, I'm a nonprofit leader. I'm very humbled by this whole experience. I was not trained, and none of us were, to deal with this kind of crisis. So again, I don't say that I have any, you know, huge amount of confidence that I've done this all right. But one thing I did when the crisis started was call two of the most experienced people on my board and just say to them around the simple question of budgeting, how do you even make a budget in a situation so uncertain? And the really good advice I got from one of my board members who's been around for 50 years involved in community development and that kind of work, you know, he said, it's really important at this moment that as a nonprofit leader, you really take stock of what is the core mission you exist to serve, and that everything you do in this financial uncertainty is organized around enabling that mission to be preserved. So getting an honest conversation with your team, with your board, with your staff, with your clients, especially to let them inform the answer about what it is that is the absolute precious gem you need to preserve through this craziness, and then make all the decisions you can in order to increase the likelihood that will be sustained. So it might be about cutting programs. It might be about furloughing staff, as terrible as that is as a leader to do. But if it's in service to really recognizing what that core is, and importantly, it also might be about going out of business. It could very well be that the best way to sustain that service in your community is to identify ways other people could carry it on, because struggling to keep your own organization afloat is frankly too distracting from that core mission you exist to serve. So I think having that, I mean, it sounds abstract, but having a very focused conversation around that question can really, and having the confidence to confront the way money intermediates the answer to that question, really is the path. And if that sounds abstract, as I said, we've got a lot of resources, others do as well, to make it easier for the non-finance experts who run these organizations to lead at this time.
And I think it's such an important point, because to your point, nobody knows. This is not just something that the nonprofit sector is dealing with. This is the level of crisis that we're all dealing with is different than most of us, any of us, have seen in our lifetime, right? And one of the things that I have seen as wisdom pushed out to the nonprofit sector is innovate, 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 innovate. And the sector has been innovating, but I think it's almost to a degree where I get concerned even for myself around mission drift, right? And really recentering the organization on what is the mission, not what is the set of activities and how can we innovate those activities, but what is the core central mission and who are we trying to serve, and staying true and having that be the center of innovation and gravity. I think it's just something that's very wise to leave our audience with. So thank you.
Yeah, and I would just add that we could do a whole episode on, you know, what's been labeled as biz-splaining and the danger of taking for-profit analogies and applying them to the nonprofit sector and think they'll work. I highly recommend, if anyone listening doesn't already, to follow Vu Lay in his blog, nonprofitaf.com. But, you know, he does as good a job as anyone of making that clear, and also quite hilarious most of the time. But yeah, it is a real danger to take some of those, you know, things we read in Harvard Business Review and think we can apply them to the nonprofit world. And a fetish on innovation is certainly one of them.
Right, right. Well, speaking of, Vu Lay is usually one of the best parts of my day. What is the best part of your day?
That's a great question. You know, I really enjoy getting to talk with my clients and my team. What we do, as I mentioned, is quite esoteric. The idea of wielding finance as a tool of liberation and social justice. And it sounds abstract, but it's really amazing for me. You know, I was at McKinsey as a consultant, often asked by my peers, why are you working on public sector or nonprofit work when, you know, McKinsey is about making money? And then I was at the Rockefeller Foundation working on impact investing, being asked by my peers, we're here to help, you know, nonprofits get grants and poor people. Why are you spending your time with billionaire investors? And it's an incredible luxury and privilege for me to be at NFF in an organization where I'm surrounded by colleagues who share this very strange focus on both finance and social justice. And it's frankly, even after 9 years, I don't take for granted what it's like to be able to work every day with people who see how we, you know, see the world in a similar way. Although, of course, we're also, as a relatively diverse team, challenging each other to think in different ways of how we can work. But certainly being with my clients, my team, it's and as the head of a nonprofit, I think the most exciting thing I get to do is create opportunities for my staff and my clients, whether that's successful fundraising or partnering. I have an amazing team, 84 people strong right now. And anytime I can bring them resources or partners that allow them to be as effective as they can be, it's a good day.
Well, that sounds motivating, and just appreciate you bringing us behind the curtain a little bit and the different parts of your world and your cross-sector experience. And thank you again for joining us, Anthony.
Thank you so much. And just, you know, in closing, I often get asked, what do I think is going to happen to the nonprofit world after the COVID crisis? We were asked that. Now it's about what's happening around the country. And, you know, all I can say is I have no idea, and I would be wary of listening to anyone who has a clear answer to the question. I don't know what's going to happen in the world, but I certainly know the world that I am fighting for alongside my colleagues and my clients and the communities we serve. And that is a world in which all communities have agency in being able to meet their own aspirations, and a nonprofit funding system that is organized around getting community-centered organizations the control of resources they need to succeed. I mean, that's ultimately what motivates us. And we get to see every day the potential that happens when you are able to get resources to these communities. And I think a lot about how do you keep your optimism and your outrage in balance. There's certainly no reason, there's no lack of reason to be outraged right now, but it's the incredible community leaders we get to support at NFF that I derive my optimism from. I just cannot believe our country will not be in better shape when I see what these people are able to achieve. And all they need is the resources and some agency and control over those resources. That seems like an easy part. Having the incredibly motivated, brilliant, committed people we have already. So that's where I get my optimism. And I hope, you know, some of your listeners are counted among that group, and we'll find ways to support them as well.
Thanks so much for listening to Pro Bono Perspectives today. If you like our show and want to learn more, check out our website at commonimpact.org. Leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues about us. Tune in to our upcoming episodes to hear from everyday leaders using their skills to help their communities.